This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. It's the 21st of September 2009 here in Japan, but it's still the 20th of September across the dateline in Hawaii, where I'm joined on the line once again by Albert Lanier. Albert Lanier is a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in publications like Honolulu Weekly and online at sites like windaction.org. Albert, thank you for joining me once again on the Corbett Report.
Well, thank you for having me once again on the Corbett Report. Hello to you, James, and also a hello to the people who patronize the Corbett Report online, those of you who are online who will listen to this interview. Hello, and my very best wishes to you all.
All right, Albert, well, it's good to have you back on today, and I understand that today you want to talk about the crisis of journalism. Can you tell us a little bit about that that topic and why you're so interested in it?
Well, I'm interested in what I term the crisis of journalism, because I am a journalist. I've been a journalist for 14 years. I've been a freelance journalist for that period, and as well as being a writer. I came up with the term, which actually emanates from a white paper that was written by a political scientist called Samuel Huntington. He wrote a white paper in the 1970s, in 1975, specifically called The Crisis of Democracy. He wrote this for the Council of Foreign Relations or Council for Foreign Relations. And my term doesn't have anything to do with the content of that white paper. It's just derived from the title of that document. And I call it the crisis of journalism because, for me, it's kind of like a white paper, except it's been verbal. I've been doing different interviews about this on different radio shows and podcasts. So for me, it's sort of a verbal or oral white paper of sorts. And what the crisis of journalism is a critique slash analysis of the mainstream news media, known by texters out there as MSM, or more specifically, MSNM, I guess, if you're specific. So, I basically examine, I analyze, and I critique the state of the news media in this country. By the way, if you hear those planes, Hawaii is not under attack. It's the Thunderbirds. So they're making, which is a aerial group, they're making these circles in the sky and basically showing off, as hot dog pilots do, as surgical precision-type aerial teams do. So hopefully they won't interrupt us again, because my apartment does not come with surface-to-air missiles. Shoot them out of the sky. But I just wanted to explain that, or for sports fans, it's pardon the interruption. In any event, I was discussing the crisis of journalism, as I mentioned, the brief recapitulation. It comes from the title of a Samuel Huntington white paper in 1975 that was written for the Council for Foreign Relations. And it's my analysis of the mainstream news media. So I analyze and critique this mainstream news media in basically three component points, or what I like to call the troika. The first aspect is what I call the economic aspect of the mainstream news media. Second is the technical. And the third is what I like to call news standards or standards of news. So that's the basic overall structure. Of the three, the standards of news or news standards is probably the lengthiest because I start they bring up what I call historical models, which I have crafted and termed myself. So they're a large part of that final point or final aspect of the troika in what I call the crisis of journalism.
I see. Well, let's start analyzing it then. So the first aspect of what we're discussing is the economics of the mainstream media?
Correct. Now, when we get into the economic situation, of course we're going to be dealing with the economic problems that have been experienced by specifically newspapers. So, when we hear about the mainstream news media, or about the news media in general, for a lot of people, they're probably aware of the fact that newspapers throughout many parts of the United States, or varied parts of the United States, are undergoing financial dislocations, shocks, fiscal trauma, etc. For example, in Colorado, the Rocky Mountain News, a newspaper, a daily newspaper, which had been around since for about 150 years, closed up shop for financial reasons. Most likely the reasons were not only having to do with our current financial or fiscal crisis, which, depending on your standpoint or whether you're an economist or just a regular layperson, depending on what you want to blame it on, you could blame it on the derivatives, or you could blame it on the subprime housing market and the dislocations that have followed, meaning the creation of disclosures in terms of housing disclosures, primarily due to variable rate mortgages, which people have been unable to pay, thus leading them their houses. So however you want to look at the economy, however you wish to analyze it, wherever you choose to place the blame, the current state of the economy has had an impact on newspapers in particular. Because newspapers, like most media operations, are reliant upon funds. They're reliant upon capital. They have to be able to spend, right? Again, we're looking at newspapers, so let's probe a little in depth about newspapers. When you have a daily newspaper, you have to have staff, you know, meaning reporters. You also have to have other employees, technical employees, who you have to have a physical plant if it's a daily, because you have to get the paper printed every day. So you have to have employees run the plant. And you have to have them in terms of office workers and et cetera. So when you have this kind of basic structure within a newspaper, right, people need to be paid. You also have to spend money in order to get the news out. So you've got operating costs, right? You have operating expenditures. So that constantly calls for assets to be expended. You need money. You have expenditures that have to go out and need to, you have to spend money. So when the credit market, as we can see currently and for the past year or so, experiences difficulties and money is harder to gain, harder to get, it has an impact on structures such as newspapers. You have to also keep in mind that newspapers also suffer from declines in revenues from advertising. So when you see that decline in revenue from advertising and also see the decline in the overall economy, again, whether it's derivative influenced or whether it's subprime market influenced, when these dovetail, what you see is a perfect storm that disadvantageously impacts newspapers. It did so for the Rocky Mountain News, and it's affecting other newspapers across the country. Take, for example, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which is now an online publication, no longer has the print copy or print edition. So this gets into the second point, which is the technological aspect. Now, when we talk about the technological aspect, we're talking primarily about the Internet. First of all, we should establish that the Internet is both competitive and it's also complementary. So it's kind of a contradictory type of use of technology for newspapers in particular. It's interesting because it's complementary in the sense that you can have a print edition and you can have an online edition and you can get different audiences with those editions, right? People who don't normally want to pick up a print edition will go online and vice versa. Now, with the economic dislocations that we see having been as a result of this rather damaged economy, rather serious and rather poor economic state that we're going through in the United States and really throughout the world, what we can see is that the Internet, as I mentioned, is not just complementary, it's competitive, meaning it's providing an alternative model. The business model of newspapers really don't work anymore. They don't really work. Because you have that the top-heavy, at least of the daily newspaper model, doesn't work anymore. If you have an alternative newspaper, that pretty much does work because you're not paying a lot of employees' salaries. You're not paying for health care. You're not paying for bonuses. You're not paying all these employee costs. you're basically going to be paying maybe a couple of staff writers, mostly freelancers, right? So you're going to pay per article. And you're only going to have a few staff people, and most likely you're probably going to send your paper out to be printed. So you don't have to pay for the physical plant, meaning a printing plant. So therefore, you don't have the kinds of costs that are associated with daily newspapers. So that business model of having a number of employees, say 200 reporters or so with a daily, plus support staff, plus other employees, plus the physical plant with the daily, that's expensive, that's costly. So if the money's running out, that business model, and it's deteriorating anyway because of technology. Why do you need 200 or 300 reporters on a newspaper when you can have 100 or less and you have a website, you have a digital experience? You know, instead of print and ink, you have text. You know, it's all digital and text. So it's a contrast, you know. I made this example before, I made this point before in another interview. It's sort of like the Borg in the Star Trek films and also in Star Trek The Next Generation television show. I don't know if you're familiar with the Borg. I don't know if you watch science fiction shows, James.
Yes, I am, actually.
Great. Now, as you recall, if you know Star Trek, the Borg, of course, do what? They assimilate people, right? So basically what they do is they take organisms that already exist and they kind of retrofit them to their own inorganic state. They take something that's organic and what happens is there's a fusion that takes the organic and mixes it with the inorganic, the flesh and blood with the metallic. That's what's happened with newspapers. They've gone from something that, if you could call print organic, something that was tangible and real, to something that is digital and seemingly unreal, you know, it does exist. Something that's in cyberspace, it's in a whole other region. It's something that's visual but not necessarily tactile. So here we see a transition that's gone on, and it's this form of technology, the internet, that's responsible for it. When newspapers become merely digital, online, text-driven entities, it becomes something that is both the same and at the same time different. So that's the technological differences, right? I guess in this case, it seems that resistance is futile because newspapers are moving more and more towards the digital model. Like, for example, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, I believe, is a web-only publication. I think I mentioned this before. And now we reach the final part, which is news standards, or standards of news. And what this means is that what we consider news and what the standards of news are have changed over the years, where it's gotten to the point that news is sort of like food, in a sense. Take an individual, right? Say you grow up and you're raised in a family where you eat only healthy food, right? You don't eat anything with MSG, with pollutants, you don't eat fast food, you don't eat anything that's store-bought, it's all organic, it all comes from a health food store, or stuff that you grew maybe on your own, on your family farm, or you're in a patch of land just outside your house or something like that, right? You eat supposedly healthy, organic food. And then, when you get older, you dabble in the fast food, you dabble in store-bought food, you dabble in non-organic food, and you get to such an extent where you get older and older and older, and that's all you eat. You don't eat the organic food anymore. You don't eat the healthy food anymore. You don't go to health food stores. You go to Safeway, you go to, Albertsons, whatever local stores that you go to, and you buy their food. Now, store-bought food isn't necessarily unhealthy, but it's not as healthy as what you received before. And if you're eating fast food, and junk food in particular, it's even worse. So what you've seen in this hypothetical person's diet is an erosion of nutritional value, an erosion of quality, an erosion of healthy alternatives in regards to food, right? when we say to people, don't smoke, you know, cut back on the drinking, I mean, you know, it's meant for their health. In fact, you probably are aware of people that have gone to the doctor, and the doctor says, you need to cut X amount of things out of your diet or else you'll die. Care about your health, you care about your diet in particular, but more specifically your health, you'll cut back on the foods. They say, cut out salt in your diet, you cut out salt in your diet. If they say, don't eat fast foods, don't eat fast foods. Now, you know, doctors aren't perfect. You know, they can be wrong, and that's a whole other show to get into, and it's not my expertise. There are other people who could speak to that. But the point that I make is what we've gone through is kind of like that hypothetical person. We've gone through perhaps not totally organic food, totally healthy food, but at least some aspects of that. We've gone from stuff that was fairly healthy for us to stuff that is now unhealthy for us in regards to news. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the project known as Project Censored.
Yes, yes, projectcensored.org.
Right, right. Now, every year they bring out the 25, I think, most censored stories, or top 10 stories. I know they have a book of censored stories every year. Now, I happen to write occasionally for an alternative weekly, Honolulu Weekly, and they print usually every year the top 10 censored stories. I always try to read it because I find it fascinating. I'm a supporter of their work. At least I believe in what they're doing. And they have a category which they call, ironically, junk food news, right? What were the big stories? And they're usually entertainment-oriented stories, right? And I'll be getting into that a little later in terms of the rise of entertainment. But what we see in regards to news is a change in what news really is, or what it is in regards to individuals read the news, watch the news, hear the news. The standards of news have decreased. And that is a problem not only for, primarily for individuals, not for journalists. You know, journalists are basically do what they're told, right? There's a quote, I was reading an interview with the journalist John Pilger, interviewed by David Barsamian in I believe it was for a radio station. I think he's alternative radio in Colorado. And he noted this. He said that many journalists now are no more than channelers and echoers of what Orwell called the official truth. They simply cipher and transmit lies. Pilger nails it on the head. The reason why journalists transmit and cipher lies is because that is basically what their function is. I mean, the function of journalists in whether it's the United States, whether it's Canada, whether it's Japan, in any country, if we're talking about the official media, the mainstream media, the corporate-owned news, as I call it, or what I like to say is con, or corporate-owned media. Their function is to provide spin, to basically transmit or to basically convey the news, what is called news, but what in actuality are lies, deceptions, prevarications, innuendo, rumor, myth, falsehoods. That's basically what the job of journalists has become. In many respects, in a sense, it's what it always was. But there were ways to get around that. Now, those ways are harder and harder because we see a wave and wave of consolidation in regards to the media. We see few companies owning many TV stations, many radio stations, and many newspapers. I believe in the U.S. alone, it's something like 6 companies own most of the major media, most of the major broadcast media, most of the major print media, most of the major media in general in this country. Or you go back to Ben Bedikian's book, The Media Monopoly, back when he did in 83, was probably, what, 20-something companies. That has diminished in over 20 years. So that's part of what people have to understand. The news is no longer the news anymore. What's happened to the news is that it's lost its nutritional value. Part of this has to do with the rise of entertainment. What we see in regards to the news that we're usually getting in the mainstream channels, in the major media channels, are basically the happenings and goings-on of people like actors, like pop stars or musical stars, and of personalities that have been inflated to become celebrities. That's a lot of what we've gained. Let me give you an example. I'm sure people heard about this in Japan, but here in the U.S., one of the big news items of this past week had nothing to do with Obama, the Republicans, the Democrats, what was going on in regards to health care, what was going on in regards to protests, what is going on in regards to anything dealing with bills that are before the Congress, whether it's health care, whether it's the energy bill, whether the other bills that are either controversial or might be controversial. Those were not really the big stories this week. One of the big stories this week had to do with a rapper at an awards show who took the mic when someone else, a country singer named Taylor Swift, was getting an award. He took the mic and said, she shouldn't have gotten the award. It should have gone to someone, Beyonce Knowles, who is another pop star. This is big news, right? Of course, the person I'm talking about is Kanye West, who, interestingly, when he was on a program on MTV, this was a couple of years ago, when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast region, he was on a program on MTV, and he blurted out at one point, George Bush doesn't like black people. And who knows, maybe he was correct. But in this instance, you know, he took the mic away from this Taylor Swift. I don't know this young lady. I have nothing against her. I have no interest in her. But this was the big story, or one of the big stories. Now, will the Earth, is this an earth-shattering event? Absolutely not. It's an entertainment story. But what we see with these entertainment stories is they become largely magnified, blown up, and considered important. The idea of pop culture and entertainment is considered important. So a lot of the news that we see in the United States, I can't speak for Japan, but a lot of the news we see in the United States reflects this emphasis on entertainment values. It's part of what I call the bread and circuses effect. See, as we know in Roman times, one of the things that Julius Caesar would do is you provide for the common people. You give them bread, and you give them circuses, entertainment. You keep them satisfied. You keep them pacified. You keep them in check by giving them something that you think they'll enjoy, right? People are interested in these entertainment personalities. They're interested in actors. They're interested in singers. They're interested in performers of all types, right? So that's part of the effect that we see in regards to entertainment. Now, again, I said, in using my example about the hypothetical person who begins to eat more and more bad food, unhealthy food, junk food in essence. The standards and erosions of news that we've seen over the years. Now, there are two basic historical models that I use in this regard, and they basically have to deal with the history of this erosion of news standards or standards of news. The first model is what I call the Fairness Doctrine model. And that, of course, is named after an FCC regulation that deals with providing different points of view depending on whatever topic or subject is being debated, analyzed, discussed. This, of course, applies to television because the FCC or the Federal Communications Commission deals primarily with TV and radio, and primarily broadcast TV, meaning the networks, local TV stations, etc. So the Fairness Doctrine model was instituted in 1949 and basically was allowed to die in 1987. Interestingly, in 1988, Rush Limbaugh, who is a well-known radio talk show host, conservative radio talk show host. His show debuted, his syndicated show, debuted in 1988. What the Fairness Doctrine model provided, what I like to call it also, is the consensus view of news. What it sees the reporter as is somebody who stands between differing points of view. So if you're going to talk about, let's just look at a very controversial subject, 9/11, right? You're going to have somebody there who's a 9/11 truth activist. You're also going to have somebody on camera who's somebody against the 9/11 truth activist and who's for the official story. That's fairness, right? That's what they call equal time. You're having both sides of an issue on, and you're being fair to them. What happened with equal time is it basically tries to find consensus. You believe this individual believes in their position. This other individual believes in their position. And what the journalist is sort of a disinterested referee, or supposedly disinterested referee, that stands supposedly like a colossus between two competing ideologies. Now, you contrast this with what eventually happened. Now, again, the Fairness Doctrine law or regulation was allowed to die in 1987. We're already beginning to see changes in the journalistic profession, primarily within television. See, what happened is someone like Lawrence Tisch comes in to CBS in the 80s. He starts cutting out bureaus. Now, I don't know if you're too familiar with CBS News. I don't know what you know about CBS News from about, say, the post-war era, like the 50s until about the 80s. Have you kind of looked into that yourself?
Well, I don't know specifically about the history of that corporation, but I'd be interested to hear about it.
Right. Well, Lawrence Tisch came in, he bought CBS, and he started cutting out bureaus. The CBS News was known as the Tiffany Network. It was known as a first-rate news organization. CBS News was known as a first-rate news organization. And part of that was having different bureaus in different cities around the world and having reporters in these bureaus and getting the kind of coverage that would, of course, reflect the consensus view of news, i.e., the Fairness Doctrine model. And the whole reigning modus operandi of that is, and this is very important to note, that news is a loss leader. The reason why news was instituted in television really to begin with, and people like Ted Coppola brought this out, because the FCC regs called for public service requirements, right? If you're a TV station or network, you had to have programming, you had to have X amount of minutes, hours devoted to public service. And one of the easiest ways to do that was to institute news broadcasts, right? That's supposedly serving the public by giving them information, by giving them facts, by giving them the truth. Oh, that last bit is controversial. So what we see is a shift from public service, or news as public service, and more importantly, news as a loss leader, to news as a profit center. News as a business, news as something that can turn a profit, as opposed to money. One of the leaders in this direction was a show that some people may have heard of called 60 Minutes on CBS. 60 Minutes basically, in my reading, in my research, in my analysis, 60 Minutes was one of the programs that proved that news could be profitable. Even though it's a magazine show, it took, seven seasons, I think, for 60 Minutes after it came on the air in about 1968, I think, 67 or 68. It took about seven seasons for them to become a top 10 show or a hit. But once it became a hit, it became a very solid hit. In fact, that's a show that has been the number one show at least for two seasons over a period of 30 years. In their history, they've been number one, the top rated program over sitcoms, over drama shows, over everything else in the Nielsen ratings. They've been number one at least twice. 60 Minutes is one of those breakthrough programs because it proved that news could be profitable. Granted, it's a news magazine show, but it provided that news programming could be profitable. So what you see in the 80s is the growth of this sort of profit-oriented schema, this profit-oriented mindset that sees news as nothing more than a product. In fact, I would define news nowadays as basically anything that editors and executives say is important, and that it's also a product. It can be bought and sold. Some people would argue with me and say no, but no. I believe that news is a product, right? But it's a product in television, for example, that's sold to advertisers, right? That's what Fox News is all about, right? And that gets into my second model, which is the ideological model. What we currently have now is the ideological model of news, which is where we had different points of view expressed in regards to news, in regards to the mindset of news, the way that reporters and anchors see themselves. What we've seen is a sea change in this aspect. What we have is a unitary as opposed to a binary look at the news. It's a unitary look at the news, and it looks at it from a particular point of view. In the mid-90s, what you saw was the formation of the Fox News Network. That was created by Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes. Ailes was a former media guy. He worked for Richard Nixon. He also worked for other Republicans. I believe he worked for Ronald Reagan. And so he had a background as basically a Republican operative. Media operative, but he's an operative. So he's the president. He comes in as the president. Rupert Murdoch, of course, is the owner and financier of Fox News. And, of course, what they do is they don't just create something out of thin air. That's very important to note. This wasn't just created, okay, right-wing news, presto. It was created based on the prevailing currents that were happening. What you saw on talk radio was the rise of Rush Limbaugh and a million other right-wing idiots. And right-wing fools screaming their pablum and their puke and their garbage, you know, 5 days a week on numerous radio stations. So you see that slow accretion, that slow buildup. And what it provides, what the ideological model basically is all about, is providing, as I mentioned, a unitary point of view, but also a partisan point of view, right? You're trying to get a political and a political ideology out to people, which is basically right-wing, right? Liberals are fools, liberals are idiots, liberals are wrong, we are right, we are correct, we have what is necessary. We are the defenders of liberty, we are the defenders of truth and justice and the American way, because we are right-wingers. Of course, they never say we're right-wingers. They just might say conservative values or conservative positions, but never, oh, we're right-wingers. That's important, right? What this serves is a function to attack directly other political groups in the country, and also in the media. It's also a profitable model unto itself. That's why Fox News has been around for more than 10 years. They're a profitable model. You know, one aspect of this, of course, someone like Glenn Beck. You know, Glenn Beck's ratings, even though he's on later in the afternoon on Fox News, his ratings are very good. I mean, he's almost up there with the guys who have been leading Fox News for a while, Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity. So what we see is, with the ideological news model, a shift to partisan, binary, political, explicitly political points of view. So it's not about showing different points of view, it's about really contextualizing. This is very important. Contextualizing the news in such a way as that people will automatically think the way you want them to think. See, what's important about the mainstream media is the media is not about mind control, as some people more, I would like to think. It's about thought control. What they want you to do is to agree with them. They want you to be sympathetic to their points of view. What the media does is it creates perceptions. And if you see enough of these perceptions, or you're led to believe that these perceptions of reality are the only form of reality, then you will believe these perceptions, and thus you will be lockstep in agreement with the bozos, the morons, the coons on Fox News. You will agree to what they're saying. So that's very important. We've gone from probably 20, 30 or more years of the consensus view of news, what I call the fairness doctrine model, to what is now more than a decade of the ideological model, very explicit right versus left. In fact, Fox News is the right-wing version of it. They call themselves fair and balanced. Well, really? You know, they also have anyone who calls themselves fair and balanced, of course, unbalanced, dangerously. Fox News also says, you know, we report, you decide. Well, I have decided, and you're biased. You're so biased that you wouldn't know the truth if it, you know, showed up and wanted to do an interview on your network. That is the big difference. But what we have is an ideological news model that is currently in vogue. And what we've seen in the with Fox News is we see a counter to this with MSNBC, because you have people like Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann. They're taking sort of the left side or the liberal side. And that's counter-programming, right? You have to have a place where the left, liberals, they can feel safe. Because there's no longer any safe ground for them, right? This is a way to not only make money, but also attack certain groups within the mainstream of America and even outside the mainstream of America. So it's a dual function. So, of course, news becomes not just a matter of, you know, not just a product, not just what editors and executives say it is, and it doesn't just become a part of the, you know, what's, it doesn't just get reduced to something that's unhealthy or non-nutritional, you know, the comparison to food. In terms of entertainment, you know, we get more entertainment news than ever before. But it's also news is something that exerts an influence on people. So what we see here is just a reduction into what is considered news. A lot of what we see on TV, even in certain publications, what we read, a lot of it's just junk, right? Use the term from Project Censor, junk food news. There's a lot of junk food news, a lot of unhealthy news that's out there. So the problem with people is they have to try to find the healthy news. They have to find the organic alternatives. And that's where the Internet is so important, and what I call the new alternative media. They're highly important in that they provide the reaction to this. They provide a place where you can, you know, eat vegetarian as opposed to eating beef, as an illustration. What's also important about the new alternative media, by new alternative media, I mean primarily the Internet as a hub for radio talk shows, for podcasts like the ones that you do with the Corbett Report, and also for websites like the Corbett Report. It's what it provides is a way to look at the news, more importantly, to contextualize the news. That's very important. See, news isn't just about facts that are communicated. It's not just about information. That information has to be contextualized. With Fox News, the contextualization is right-wing, pseudo-conservative, because I don't think there are any real conservatives in this country anymore. But it's right-wing. So that's the contextualization that's the sort of prism that it's seen through. And MSNBC is more left, more liberal. But with the new alternative media, I think people have the chance to contextualize it on their own. They can go to these different sites like the Corbett Report or others that I've done interviews with and been appeared on, Media Monarchy, TV News Lies, various others. People can go to sites like the ones Alex Jones has with Prison Planet and InfoWars and listen to his shows. And that's a way to break through the what I like to call the con job, the corporate-owned news job. And to break through the corporate-owned media and to contextualize the news yourself. What the internet does is it allows you to pick and choose, contextualize yourself, and render your own verdict. Unlike Fox News, you get the point, you get to decide, not some editor or some producer at Fox News, not some reporter or anchor at Fox News or MSNBC. You get to decide. And that's why the internet is so very important. That's why the new alternative media is so very important. And that's why the threat to the internet is something that's very serious in regards to this media. It's extremely serious.
Absolutely. Well, when you speak of threats to the internet, what threats do you see coming on down the pipeline?
Yeah, based on what I've read over the years, the buying up of internet service providers or ISPs, the control of places like YouTube, for example, those are threats because they're seeking to change the way that people can, what videos they can show. For example, the Alex Jones Show, I think they had a channel on YouTube, and at one point it was shut down. And a tremendous number of individuals, sent emails and complained that this was being shut down, and they reinstated it. You know, it's a matter, what the internet represents is true democracy. Don't have in this country. We don't have true democracy. We have what passes for democracy, what they say is democracy. It's not true democracy. But the threat to the internet really ultimately comes down to, at least from what I've heard and what I've read, is the idea that the internet can be treated like cable, right? Like they will get meaning the corporations, the companies that are the major service providers, the major internet providers, will basically bundle up various websites and offer them to you when you pay for the right to go online. If you go to America Online or if you go to or MSN or any of these other services, you will have to pay, your regular monthly amount, but you'll only get to visit X amount of sites, the approved sites. It's kind of like cable, right? When you get cable in the U.S., you get X amount of channels. And those are the channels that you have, that the packages that they give you, right? So you'll get a package, and this package will be X amount of websites. Let's say you'll get a package of, 10,000 websites, right? You can only, you're allowed to go to these websites and those websites only. If you try to go to another website, you won't be able to do it. They'll have some kind of screen or some kind of some form of technology that will block it, kind of like a V-chip or something like that. That's what I would think they would need to do to kind of prevent people from, what that would mean is restricting freedom, restricting access. Because if you're restricting access on the internet, you're basically restricting freedom. So that's what I kind of see coming up. I mean, I've been reading about this for years. It just hasn't happened to such an extent that we're totally cut off from the World Wide Web in its entirety. You can only access so many websites. But I believe if they get their way, if the corporations, the companies get their way, that may very well be a reality. But we'll have to see.
Well, there's no doubt there is that corporate attack vector against the free and open internet. And of course, as my listeners are probably well aware, there's also the Rockefeller-sponsored Cybersecurity Act that's being reintroduced into the House this session. And is, well, according to the wording in the legislation itself, would, in the event of a national emergency as declared by the White House, the president would be given authority to shut down any public or private networks as he sees fit for the duration of the emergency. And we all know how that can be used as a tool, exactly as the September 14th, 2001 Declaration of National Emergency was just renewed for the 8th straight year by President Obama. Yes, can you feel the change? Well, I guess I certainly agree with all of the points of your analysis, but I guess my dispute is with the way in which it's framed, because this doesn't seem to me a crisis of journalism. In fact, quite the opposite. I see a flowering of journalism in that new alternative media that you identify online. And for maybe for the first time in decades, we are actually able to truly set up something outside of the corporate-controlled strictures. So the crisis, to me, is one of the crisis of corporate control over the news. And there's, at the same time as this new alternative media is rising, there's such an awakening to the fact that we are being fed palatable corporate pablum and that being passed off as news or infotainment, whereas people are now so hungry for the truth that they are finding alternative websites that are providing unfiltered news. So to me, this is actually a flowering of democracy and something to be celebrated.
Well, as I mentioned at the very beginning, the crisis is that which is affecting the mainstream news media, corporate-owned media, newspapers, TV stations, radio, what have you. It hasn't affected the new alternative media because they don't play by corporate rules. I'm an independent journalist. I've been an independent journalist for 14 years. I don't play by corporate rules. I've never worked for the New York Times or CBS or CNN or Fox or MSNBC. So I don't play by their rules. The crisis is that which is within the journalistic profession. But when we talk about the new alternative media, we're talking outside of the normal structures, the traditional structures of journalism. Because when we talk about journalism, as I mentioned with my quote from John Pilger, many journalists are basically, as he mentions, channelers and echoers of Orwell's phrase, the official truth. Right? They cipher and transmit lies. That's very important to note. They cipher and transmit lies. What the mainstream news media is about is putting forth its agenda. It's putting forth its belief systems, putting forth what they want people. The very act of news means deciding what gets to be shown, what gets to be printed, what gets to be broadcast. That in and of itself is control. That in and of itself is undemocratic. Now, some people may have a problem with my saying it. They may say, how can you as a journalist say that news in and of itself is undemocratic? It's very simple. Let's just use an example. If I come to your house, James, I come to Japan, I come to your house, and I come to your house and I decide, well, I'm going to decide, say I stay with you, and while I'm staying with you as a guest, I decide what kind of food you're going to eat, and I decide, you know, what kind of beverages you're going to drink. And I exert my pressure in that way. So even though it's your house, even though you buy the food, you buy everything, it all technically seems to belong to you. I exert my influence and I say, well, no, what you need to do is get this type of food, or you need to get this kind of drink, or you need to do this in regards to, you need to buy this kind of TV or this kind of DVD, right? I'm exerting an influence that is disproportionate to my status, right? That's the same aspect with the news, right? They're exerting an influence. The very aspect, the very idea that news is something that is chosen by professionals is undemocratic. The very essence of news is undemocratic. Again, that's something that I as a journalist shouldn't say, but it's true. It's true. So what the Internet provides is it provides individuals with the chance to choose what they perceive as news. You, in a sense, aren't so much a journalist, but you're kind of like an editor. You're kind of like a producer. Okay, I want to check out this story. That's news to me. Or I want to go and check out this interview that James Corbett did with Moulton, the activist, the 9/11 truth activist, who has a documentary out. So I'll watch that. It allows the individual, the Internet allows the individual to not be a journalist per se, although some people are putting up websites and they're doing documentaries and they're doing their own TV or web-based TV shows. It allows them to become editors and producers in their own right, and they get to choose the news. So that's where the democratic aspect of the new alternative media comes from. And in a sense, there has been a flowering. But for a lot of people, it still hasn't reached them. You know, the Internet is still seen as something that is distrusted, something that isn't sanctioned, something that isn't part of the mainstream. And they would be absolutely right. It isn't part of the mainstream. It isn't sanctioned in many respects. I mean, you know, How many times have you appeared on CNN?
Exactly zero.
I can say that I have appeared exactly zero as well. Because we're not part of the mainstream. I mean, I've written for mainstream publications in Hawaii, you know. I've written for magazines. I've written for newspapers, in a sense, that'd be considered mainstream. But I'm not a part of the mainstream. I'm outside of the mainstream. The issue of the news and the issue of what journalism is going to be in the rest of this century and beyond is one of whether we're going to have freedom to determine what news is for ourselves, as opposed to are we going to allow the same old powers that be dictate, as they have for years and years and years, for decades, what they think the news is, and thus what they think we should believe the news is. That's very important when we discuss journalism. We discuss not only the mainstream news media, but also what I call the new alternative media that has sprung up. So is the flowering of this new alternative media good? Yes, in the sense that it provides choice. But is the crisis of journalism good? Well, in many respects, it isn't. But that's a problem that doesn't just impact journalists, it impacts everyone else. We're still affected by the mainstream media. We're still affected by CNN, Fox News, MSNBC. It's still all around us. So we can't necessarily get away from the impacts of the crisis of journalism, even if we have this new alternative media that is flowering. Because, as I mentioned with the Internet, we don't know how long this is going to continue, how long you may be able to do the Corbett Report. I can't honestly answer that question. There may come a time fairly soon where the Corbett Report may not get as many people logging on to it. There may not be as many people be able to access the Corbett Report. This is very important to consider.
It certainly is, and I think we have to be on guard against utopianism or idealism. I think we have to be on guard against idealizing journalism's past and freedom from corporate control, because it seems to me that people like William Randolph Hearst were just the Rupert Murdochs of their day, and that the corporate control has always been there to a certain extent. We also have to guard against idealizing the alternative media, because, of course, there is a lot of shoddy journalism and bad journalism out there in the alternative media as well. So I think the point is, as you made there quite eloquently, is the fact that the new alternative media represents choice, which does not always equate to 100% good content, but at least gives us the ability to use our own discernment to filter out what is good and what is not good in terms of news media. So extrapolating from the point where we're at now, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but looking forward, how do you think this is going to play out in the coming years? What next steps are we going to see in this crisis?
Well, the crisis inevitably is going to lead to the clash, right? We're already seeing this clash, right? It's what I call the new alternative media, and the new alternative media is beginning to rub up against the corporate-owned media, right? The Internet is something that the mainstream media still has issues with and still has problems with. They don't mind using it. They don't mind dealing with it. They don't mind exploiting it. But they don't want anyone else to exploit it and use it to contextualize the news for themselves, to choose the news in order to be the news. I've gone on other shows and I said, if you really don't like the mainstream news media, if you really can't stand it, and if you really have the intelligence and the talent, create your own media. Create your own websites, like you did with the Corbett Report. Create your own web-based TV shows. Be your own CNN. Be your own Fox. No, I scratched that. You don't want to be your own Fox. That's terrible. But be your own news network. Be your own radio station. Be your own web-based publication, magazine, newspaper. Be the media if you feel very strongly about it. You know, be that alternative to what we see, most of it garbage, most of it filth, most of it just trash. It's disgusting what we see in the mainstream news media today. You know, I've just gotten to a point where it's sort of like, I feel like I'm in, I use this analogy all the time. You know, I talk about the Matrix, and one of the things we have to understand is that the news media creates perceptions. I think I mentioned this before. They create perceptions, and that's how they get people to go along with what they have. But we're really living in a matrix. The matrix, of course, are the perceptions that are created by the mainstream news media. And a lot of people believe these perceptions. They believe that there were WMDs in Iraq. They believe the official story of 9/11. They believe that Oswald killed Kennedy. There are people who believe all these things. At the same time, there are a number of people who haven't drunk, who haven't imbibed the Kool-Aid. They haven't taken any of the red or blue pills. There are people who question. There are people who assert themselves. There are people who say, what is being mentioned, what is being touted is untrue. They're lies. And they fight back by printing or trying to print the truth or trying to post the truth. Maybe they don't get the truth. Maybe some of it doesn't work. Maybe some of it's crazy. But they make an effort. They try. And that's what it's ultimately going to come down to. We're at a stage. You know, I was listening to some interview. I think it was with Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. He said, well, anyone with a cell phone, you know, is kind of like a film. You know, anyone with a camera is a filmmaker. Anyone with a cell phone is a journalist. Or anyone who, you know, has a website, is an editor, or what have you, nowadays. And of course, what he was going for is, well, what we need to do is we need to trust the more reliable sources, the teachers, the priests, the networks like this one. But we're reaching a point where we can't trust the authorities. We can't trust the sources that we have been brainwashed, that we have been taught, that we have been pushed and cajoled to believe in. We're saying there are those of us who say that it's wrong. There are those of us who say it's not correct. There are those of us who say we don't believe you. You can keep lying. You're free to do that in this country. But we don't have to believe your lies. And that is what we see with the new alternative media. As someone who works in the media, for me, I'm not looking to create my own blog. I'm not looking to create my own site. I'm a journalist, and I'm probably going to be a journalist till I retire. But I see this change, this difference that didn't happen when I started in this field. You know, there were no websites dealing with issues like the Corbett Report deals with. You know, whether it's vaccines or whether it deals with 9/11 or whether it deals with the Federal Reserve, we didn't have that. You know, if you wanted to deal with various aspects like the Federal Reserve, you had to go look up books. You know, you had to do the research by looking up magazine articles, by reading books, by reading whatever documents you could get your hands on personally, do personal research. Now you can go online and read all this stuff. Maybe you won't get everything, but you'll get some things. So it's a matter of people learning to be their own editors and producers. That's more important than being your own journalists. Now, journalists are basically tools. They're like puppets. They get manipulated. That's what Lyndon Johnson said once. You know, journalists are basically like puppets. I forget the exact quote, but it's manipulation. You know, they're company men and women, right? Most journalists, probably shouldn't say this, but most journalists in this country are cowards. I understand why they're cowards. You know, they got families, and they got mortgages, and they want to do well by their wives or husbands. You know, they want to be able to provide for their children, and I understand that. I completely understand it. I don't have a family. I don't have kids. But I understand it. But you're still a coward. You're still a corporate shill. You're still someone who's taking orders from individuals who don't care about the truth, that don't care about the facts, that just want to foment lie after lie after lie. They don't care about news. The news to them is what matters. Not certainly has nothing to do with the truth. And we take another program to get into specific news and specific truths. But they don't care. Fox News doesn't care. CNN doesn't care. MSNBC doesn't care. None of these organizations care. The networks don't care. ABC, NBC, CBS. They care about making their money. They care about ratings, and they care about doing what they have to do to survive as broadcast entities. That's what they care about. And when it comes to newspapers, it's a little better. You know, sometimes you can find a little nugget of truth here and a little nugget of truth there. The print media is certainly better than the televised media, TV, radio, what have you. But it's still the same thing. You know, they want to make money. They want to, you know, they want to survive. They want to do what they have to do, these large corporate entities. So when you look at the mainstream media, you know, they have an agenda. Their agenda is not necessarily red and blue. It's green to make money. Not Democrat and Republican necessarily, although that has something to do with it. It's to make money. You know, it's survival. It's being able to move on and onward and upward. So if you want the truth, if you want the facts, you have to read what's out there and then do a little digging or, you know, talk to people. You have to find the truth. You can't, it won't be delivered to you on a platter. That's what's going to happen in the years ahead. I believe there's going to be a clash between this new alternative media and the mainstream media. It's already happening. The question is, who will survive? Will the internet survive as we know it? Will new alternative media survive as we know it? Or will it be crushed and destroyed? That's a question. That's, I don't have the answer to that.
Well, neither do I, obviously, but I guess I just have faith in humanity that they'll be able to see through the lies, spin, and disinformation of the corporate-controlled media and corporate shills like Thomas Friedman, and realize that when Thomas Friedman criticizes new alternative media, it's like a horse and buggy salesman criticizing the fledgling auto industry, and should be taken for what it's worth, which is absolutely nothing. But at any rate, Albert Lanier, it's always a pleasure to have you on, and tell people about how they can find some of your work, maybe online or in the real world.
Right. Well, of course, I would encourage people to, you know, listen. If you're listening to this interview, listen to it again. To visit Corbett Report. If you want to look at alternative stories, alternative articles, if you want to contact me, you can go to my email account. You can send me an email at ajlanier01@msn.com. That's ajlanier01@msn.com. So that's how you can contact me. I've done other interviews on other sites, and you can check them out. Do a search on my name. And I've also done an interview for this site about wind power environment. I would access that interview as well. I don't want to go too far into that direction because I've already covered it on the Corbett Report, but I would take a look at that interview. I think it's interview number 85 on the site. I would check that interview out too if you have those interests or are interested in the environment, if you're interested in wind power, and I'm a critic of wind power, so I would definitely check out what's on the Corbett Report and other sites, and also the mainstream media. You know, read what's out there, see what's on TV. Just don't allow yourself to be brainwashed by what they consider the news to be.
All right. Well, Albert Lanier, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on the crisis of journalism today.
Thank you very much for having me.